their pencils and papers out and were figuring how many Chinese they could afford to subsidize to come for an educational purpose. We had to tell them, I'm sure you remember this, that look, let's not start bidding against ourselves. Let's wait till we hear from them as to the specifics. They had already, without question, indicated yes, they were.
So then it was the morning break. But at some point, I remember that we heard. Then my memory still is not clear. That either in the morning or the afternoon, the first half, there was a veiled reference to sending students. But everyone was so certain among the analysts that the Chinese would not move forward on anything until normalization, that they were reading into the presentation that view. You know, this goes back to the whole business that this trip was very carefully planned.
Well, I think both elements were present in the morning. But yes, they'd be willing. And I thought the number 500 was floating around at that point. But it was not necessarily, yes, we'll do it now. Yes, we're willing to do this, but it well could be we're willing to do this after other things have happened. But nevertheless, at the noontime, there were individuals on the American side, not the analysts, but those who had agencies and funds at their disposal. And then when we came back in the afternoon, Fong Yi gave this very tough rendition about how slow we were moving, and I suppose that they'd have gotten from Wang Hua that we were proposing this long, drawn-out exercise, which they possibly thought wasn't going anywhere. And then we took the break, which he called for.
I got a check. Yeah.
Took the break and he comes back, and it was then a discussion of detail. And I think he started almost from the beginning, we will pay all the costs. I just know from subsequent discussions and reactions that they had no idea what the costs were of sending a student not only to the United States but to any other country. And I think they much regretted that strong assertion, we will pay all the costs.
Do you believe that the press visit itself was a catalyst forcing that decision?
Well, it occurred to me that the lack of trained manpower is such a burden to that society that they did want to get the thing moving. I'm sure there would have been those in the upper ranks of the Chinese system who were very not too happy with this. It well could have been a compromise. Well, okay, if we're going to do it, we're not going to do it in the old way where we were their clients. Mm-hmm. We'll send them as totally independent of the receiving country. And I repeat, I am sure, without any knowledge at all of costs, you know, they may have turned to a Joe Peiyuan as to, well, what are costs? And his memory of what costs were, even if with some theoretical upgrading, would certainly be wide of the mark as to what in fact they were in 1978. But it was a momentous day. And I think we all agreed at the end of that day that it was really remarkable that they had gone so far forward.
That's right. I Well, we'll continue, then I'll talk a little more about the press trip.
No, this is a good time to talk about it.
Because I feel that Frank Press's trip in some ways was more significant than Biggs. Biggs set the stage. He helped establish the normalization negotiations. But that probably could have been done another way. The bureaucrats in Washington did not permit doing it another way, but we could have gotten the normalization negotiations just by having started just by having you go in. His trip helped establish a strategic or it's helped provide the conceptualization strategically to permit that. But
I think had very considerable, if not enormous, influence within the Chinese.
Did it?
I think so.
Huh. Well, be that as it may.
You know, the fact that he was the
The
NSC advisor to the president, thinking back to
Kissinger.
The 71, 72 Kissinger Nixon business. I think the two were supplementary, one to the other.
The other, but I think the Frank Press one induced decisions that may have been much more difficult for the Chinese to have taken, and in that sense was really served a catalytic role. I'd have no evidence for proving that, but if one goes back even to Biggs' trip, on Biggs' trip the basic view was that we look forward to move to progress on normalization, but until normalization very few things are possible.
Of course, from where I was sitting, since I had thought I had been doing everything I could to have the Chinese understand without saying it to them directly, which was impossible, there were certain things we're going to have to do with regard to Taiwan after normalization. But assuming they knew that, and I didn't see how they could not know it, that this meant that, yes, they had made up their mind to go ahead. Not sure of the timetable, certainly, but it just strengthened my belief that we were on the right road.
Right. Well, and probably your own discussions, both within the embassy, which presumably they were listening into, as well, within the liaison office, I should say, as well as to them, that they had a role to play in creating a climate that would facilitate normalization was important. And I think probably they saw now that we were committed, and therefore they had to begin to play their responsible role to indicate that,
right.
And so their receptivity, the Frank Press visit probably was in that context as well.
Now, the press group did not see Deng Xiaoping.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Was I not there?
I would have to check my picture of that meeting, but I'll tell you, this was a meeting in which Deng said, "Why don't you come on over and develop our coal mines?" Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
It was an incredible statement where he
here it is. Press group meeting with Deng Xiaoping on the morning of the 10th of July.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Same day that the group left. Right.
In the afternoon.
Yeah. Now you mentioned the coal mines. Yes, definitely.
He had... the group broke down for a series of counterpart talks with which
right.
you were not involved, but you had all of the people and the embassy sort of drained because you had someone from the embassy at each of the counterpart talks.
Who supplied the note takers in the
That's right.
sessions.
And it was an electric moment. I went over with Dick Atkinson of NSF, but about... this was held in the Friendship Hotel compound.
Right.
And they had set up a whole hall where these counterpart meetings were to take place. We arrived, and the place was just a beehive of activity and excitement.
No, the liaison office staff was delighted. They worked very hard, and I think did very well. But they really loved it.
Yeah, yeah. It was a real one sense, the beginnings of a relationship taking off, I think, in that.
And it was that visit, too, that some of my ambassadorial colleagues would say, why do you want to normalize? You have all the advantages of full diplomatic recognition without some of the obligations. Of course, at that time, some of the obligations, every time a head of state came, all ambassadors were required, certainly expected to go out to the airport to greet, to be stand in line to greet the incoming head of state. And many times this was in the wintertime. And also to attend the dinner that the Chinese gave. Depending upon the wealth of the country, whether or not they might be invited to the return dinner. This was an awfully, these dinners were awful, deadly chores. All of this, later that year of 78, was eliminated. But we did have, that began a relationship for the American liaison office, which outranked many embassies.
Well, that was the idea. The idea was to use science and technology as an instrument of foreign policy. And Frank Kress really pushed that idea within the White House. He advocated it not only toward China, but toward Brazil, toward the Soviet Union. In that sense, our policy, I think the writers of the outside analysts of Carter administration China policy have really missed how our policy differed from Kissinger's. I think Kissinger in 1974, 73, 74, had the opportunity to do the exact same thing. And the Chinese would have responded even then. But he never saw the role of knowledge as because he was so power-oriented in a way that he did not see military power. I mean, he did not see how knowledge and science could be used as a way of broadening our contacts with another country. He was also very fearful that if he brought in the scientists, the relationship would escape his control. And he didn't want other people going off.
Yeah, well, the greater the scope of the relationship, the more he would feel that his influence is diluted.
That's right. And it's big, on the other hand, to Biggs' credit, he saw this as a great opportunity. And President Carter, too, took a very deep personal interest in the project.
You know, the Australian ambassador, sometime after this, but still in 78, came to see me. And
was this Steve?
No, this was Harry Woodard, this Fitzgerald's successor. And his premier, I guess, was coming to China. And he hoped for a meeting with Deng Xiaoping. And could I help him with what to expect? He'd been there by this time at least 2 years. Had never been in a meeting with Deng Xiaoping. So that as they watched this unfolding American relationship, some were pleased, and of course some were not so pleased. And the press visit, of course, was enhanced in the eyes of the Chinese when his visit, which was to follow with the Soviet Union, was scrubbed because
of
what
course.
Was at Sakharov.
That's right, of course.
Yeah.
The, of course, what no one knew, and what your fellow ambassadors in Peking did not know, was that the trip occurred against the backdrop of normalization negotiations having been initiated. so that one could not say we were having everything without normalization. I felt that the fact that your talks had opened was absolutely essential for the success of Frank's trip.
I might say that in this whole period from July to December, I was in quite a few meetings where American groups would meet with vice premiers who would say, quite often in the course of it, "Oh, Ambassador Woodcock knows about that in the negotiations." And they would say to me afterwards, "Negotiations? What negotiations?" "Oh," I said, "we're always negotiating." That would satisfy them, but it was not as closely held on the Chinese side as it was on our side.
Well, we had to go in and scold Deng a couple times. Do you remember
right.
that? I called Cao Guisheng in Washington once, and because Deng, on his trip to Japan, referred to the talks they were carrying out.
Right. Yes.
And I really read him a riot act. I was quite incensed.
And usually when this was said, it would be said with a wave of the hand and a big smile as though, well, everybody knows this, of course.
Exactly.
But that was a great meeting.
It's also that meeting of press and Deng Xiaoping, I thought, Deng was just very impressive. That was one of the most impressive meetings I have seen him in. Two regards. He's always exhibited great intellectual curiosity, but that was so evident there that he, what he didn't know, he was ready to admit and ready to learn. And secondly, I guess he came closer to articulating his vision, what he hoped, what he saw for China's future, than I had heard him expound at other times.
Of course, Frank Press was almost as though he was tailor-made for that event. His demeanor, his personality, everything was almost perfect. Remember, he had the trouble with his foot, which I guess finally somebody said, "Why didn't you get acupuncture?" And they came out late that night and said, "Acupuncture won't do you any good." And they bound it up,
mm-hmm.
and then the next day x-rayed it and found a
broken bone.
Yeah. But he was, in fact, all the members of that group handled themselves extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all obviously full of enthusiasm, which I think communicated itself to the Chinese.
Okay. But that was also due to Frank. He really put that group together, and the briefings were excellent. We met with them several times. It was just very, very well done.
Right. Well,
my gosh.